offering our humble pranams at Bhagwan's lotus feet. Dear listeners, we welcome you to this week's episode of Shravanam, Mananam, Nididhyasanam. Those of you who have been following us will know that we are going through the 1991 summer course series. The last time around we went through the 1990 summer course series. We completed one entire discourse, and last week we began with the second discourse. We heard two clips in that discourse, about 15 minutes into that discourse. That's when we concluded last week's episode. A very, very interesting episode. Those of you who were with us last week would agree, and I'm just waiting to get into the discourse because it's only going to get even more interesting. But before we begin, as always, Prakash is with me, and as we have some time, we also have a guest. But today's guest is no guest to the listeners of Radio Sai. We have our own Karuna Munshi, who's going to join us today. So definitely this is going to be a very interesting session. Sairam Didi, and welcome to Shravanam Mananam Nididhyasanam.
Sairam, and thank you for having me.
And I'm not going to quiz you to name the program.
Thank you. I feel much relieved.
And I know that I think one of the persons who often came and told us, why did you choose such a long name, and you know, how do you pronounce it? And the last time around, when the name we thought we chose revealed itself, how it got named, I think it was so beautiful for all of us. When I think it was the last discourse, right?
It was the last line of the last discourse, and it was so dramatic because I think about a year and a half had passed from the time we had started the Shravanam Mananam series, the first series, and we had no idea because the printout that we have doesn't often reflect all the words that Swami says. But the last line of the last discourse, Swami says, Ide Shravanam Mananam Nididhyasanam.
Oh, what a perfect seal of approval.
I mean, if he had decided the name maybe 30 years ago when he gave the discourses, and 37 years ago when I was born possibly.
makes you feel so wonderful. This morning when we were going through the Ramayana, we were going through that episode where the Govardhana hill is uprooted, and you know, it starts crying, and Rama says, don't worry, in the next birth when I come. You know, when you go through the story in Dwapara Yuga, Krishna's story, you know, it's so dramatic. Mm-hmm. The villagers refuse to offer prayers, and Indra gets angry, and his ego needs to be corrected. So much for Indra's ego that it was all pre-planned one full yuga before.
Yes.
Even his ego was pre-planned.
Right. Even his ego and his arrogance and how he had to be corrected and everything. And if that is the amount of detailed planning God does, I mean, one program and which spanned about 2 years, I think.
It's nothing.
Is nothing in front
and
of that.
And it tells you that, you know, in the drama, everybody's role is so well scripted, we shouldn't take ourselves too seriously.
Absolutely.
That's right.
Right. And in fact, even as we're going through the discourse, one of the things which Swami mentioned last week was about when you go through life, especially looking out for moments and trying to connect and trying to understand, one of the obvious things which should come out of that is humility. It's when it strikes you that, you know, it's so much of it is so much larger than me. You know,
yes.
I'm such a small person in this entire scheme of thing. And in fact, that's one of the things we'll come to that. As we said last week, this discourse did appear a little different because the way Swami approached it, there was so much of what do we say? There was a certain amount of depth in the time which Swami took to convey whatever he had to convey in those first 15 minutes.
Looking at it more scientifically, there was more gravity in each word, I would say.
Yeah,
each word. There was a lot of, deliberate pause. And there was a sense of brevity which we really didn't see in others.
And I only started reading this discourse since yesterday, since you invited me to join you. And I found that it is a very well-planned lesson plan.
That's a perfect teacher
could have done this, because Swami has given an abstract of an entire thesis, and in his infinite wisdom, I found it intersects the story of human evolution from various perspectives, such as anthropology, philosophy and human geography.
Right.
Because he maps the progression and evolution of human thought very carefully, and it's a very profound topic, but Swami made it so simple in bite-sized portions that he served to his students so that we could understand it. And he clearly recognized that man in his early stages, he was in awe of the mysteries of nature and elements, and that's why he realized how small he was, as you mentioned, in the greater scheme of things. This huge dose of wonderment and awe forced us to recognize, I believe, the unrecognizable. And while trying to study the enormity of the cosmos or the mysteries that lie hidden within it, it forced humanity to acknowledge the incognito presence of a mysterious force or a principle. And Swami made it so clear that this is the principle of singularity, that one that became many, the one that looks like many. And I guess human beings, we just struggle to define everything, whether it is a relationship with anything or the phenomena around it. So Swami taught us how we evolved by trying to understand it in terms of nature, through numbers or through names. So this compulsion, we have to define every relationship in our life. This higher principle, is it bigger than me? Is it the sun? Is it the number? Is it the Gayatri Mantra? So I would say the whole perspective, I found it to be strikingly spiritual, because as they say, you know, spirituality is about defining your relationship with God. Religion is more about crowd control. This is definitely very spiritual. I was wowed by this discourse that you shared with me.
Right. I think one of the striking things which occurred to this is just like how the primitive man would have gone around. You know, the first thing which Swami says in that opening remarks is he says that the world is the basis of everything.
Yes.
Right. Because the first thing when you look around, you try to understand everything from the world around. You don't look beyond it. You say that everything happens within it, so everything which I want to know is within this. And one thing which Swami would often say is that comparison between animal and man, what is different?
Right.
If you think, if you want to define the life of an animal, I think it's all about answering the question how. You know, how do I get food?
Okay.
How do I get the partner? Mm-hmm. How do I protect myself?
Mm.
And many times when you see, man also does the same thing, but man has this extra intelligence which he has used to redefine that question of how. You know, and that's what Swami says in the later part, where he says, first, man looks around nature and he says, okay, I need the sun. There are some activities I can do in the day, some activities that have to be done only in the night. So that understanding sets in. And then this idea of fire and wind and all of that comes. After that, the stage comes where he can manipulate the elements to a limited amount. You know,
yes.
Okay, there is fire. I can create fire. I can control fire.
Yes.
But at the same time, there are some aspects of fire which I cannot understand. Like what Swami said, the beautiful point of, you know, all the while the fire is within the dry twigs,
yeah.
But the dry twigs don't get burnt up.
Correct.
So Swami is saying that, you know, here is an element. First, I didn't understand it. Now I understand it. I can manipulate it. But still, I don't understand it completely because it's, you know, there is no way I can understand it completely.
And it's so mind-boggling that it leaves a big question mark about what's going on around me and who's responsible.
Right. And then Swami says about, you know, I think that was a very beautiful point that Swami said about childbirth. You know, when you see, when as an elder you look at the child, you see the first thing the child needs or craves for is something to satiate the hunger.
Yes.
So it's almost, Swami says, that's the first problem you encounter. You know, the way Swami put it, he said the first problem a human life encounters is hunger. So Swami says that is the lowest, you know, that is the most basic. But if we're going to live our entire life only to sort out that problem, then there's something, so much more is left out.
That's right. Then, you know, after that, he very beautifully took it to how man started observing nature. And you know, once his basic necessities are met with, I suppose,
right.
You start looking at nature, you start trying to understand what nature means and trying to see how nature sustains you. And this beautiful topic of how the sun was looked at as a form of divinity itself. And even now, I think there are so many traditions where we worship the sun. There are festivals associated with worship of the sun. And, you know, looking at it from a scientist's point of view, possibly they would say this is just one sun amongst millions of other suns in the cosmos and in creation. But what matters really is, it is this sun that is sustaining us.
Mm-hmm.
And so what's wrong with looking at a God in this sun? After all, this is the conflict that possibly scientists have with our ancient thought. They always look at it as a law of nature. These are forces of nature, and this is natural. But who gave them those qualities? I mean, why should there be a Big Bang? Why should the universe expand? Why should there be condensation? Why should these things happen?
And why should there be photosynthesis so that we can make food? And I think the early man was quite intelligent to recognize it, because not only in the Indian culture, but also in other ancient civilizations such as the Greek and the Mayan, sun worshipping was very common.
Right.
We, for example, in India, we chant the Aditya Hridayam. It's a special prayer only dedicated to sun god, because sun is seen as the provider of sustenance and life force. And that's how the concept of the Gayatri Mantra came into being, because we realized that when we worship sun, we are worshipping a life-giving principle.
Mm-hmm.
And in this connection, just a slight digression, I recall that in the 1980s, I think 1981, when the Satisa Institute of Higher Learning was founded, Swami spoke to us as students and said that you have a greater responsibility now, because this university bears my name. And you must strive to do well so that the university is well recognized. We were the first batch of students to graduate from the Sai University. And Swami made a mention of the power of the Gayatri Mantra. He says, as students, when you study, you're so anxious, you're so stressed out at exam time. But when you go to write your exam, the ability to recall what you have studied at the right moment, the exact material that you need to reproduce, and to express it well, that happens when you are plugged into the cosmic intelligence. Oh. And Gayatri provides the ramp to connect to the cosmic consciousness so that you can recall, recollect. And I have found, since I was not always very careful with my studies, I would, in my desperation, chant so much Gayatri that I would actually learn my lesson or the topic while I was answering. In the moment, somehow something would click, and all the days of lessons by my professors, during which time sometimes I would be daydreaming or distracted, which was not the right thing to do, it would all click, and as I wrote, I understood what I was writing. I think such is the power of the Gayatri. Mm-hmm. And ancient Indians recognized it very early when they were in awe of the power of the sun.
Right.
I used to wonder, especially when now, if you say that every human mind is capable of all the knowledge in the world. Mm-hmm. That's something which Swami would often say. I think that was something which was mocked at by scientists for so long. You know, unless you learn it, you don't know it.
Yeah.
There's nothing like you can contact something, you know, it comes from within. But something which Swami always said, I think that's one of the things which Swami had told Professor Gokak, when he asked, you know, Swami, how is it that you know of all these philosophers you're naming and all this? And Swami said, no, it's not like that. Every human mind has the ability to connect. But you know, today you look at the cell phone, you know it, there is something called a SIM card which actually has a memory capacity of 128 KB or something like that, 200 KB or something. But the amount of data that it can access is actually unlimited. It runs into thousands and thousands of TB.
Exactly.
And that's precisely what the human brain is like. It has the capacity to access any amount of knowledge, only it has to be tuned to the right, you know, signal in the tower for me.
In fact, you know, after Swami spoke about the sun, then he went on to the numbers.
Yes.
And, you know, I couldn't help just going back and reading a little bit about Ramanujan, the mathematician, the star mathematician from India. You know, much of his mathematics was inspired. Not much. I mean, all of it. He had no formal training as a mathematician. And most, all of it was just inspiration. And he says, there's a beautiful quote. He says, an equation for me has no meaning unless it expresses as a thought of God.
Wow.
And his greatest discoveries in math, or I don't know, call it invention or discovery of mathematics, happened via visions. So he was so devoted to Namagiri Devi. So he would worship her, and you know, his visions, she would reveal aspects of herself which translated into his mathematical formulae. And he would you know, kind of relate most of his equations and most of it to her aspects, to her manifestations and how different it is from the so-called objective scientific thinking. I mean, they come to the same end. At the end, they come to the same, but how much more beautiful this is.
Intuitive mathematics.
Exactly.
I think that mantra, Purnamada, Purnamidam, kind of sums it up, because it speaks of infinity and the parts of infinity and the infinity of each part and the perfection of each part. That's
right.
Like cosmic math. Wasn't Ramanuja the person who gave us the zero?
That's right. He's the one who gave the zero and many more things, you know. His, I believe, his theories and his concepts of mathematics are finding new relevance in string theory and other theories that are being discovered today. And they go back to his theorems and say that, yes, they are being verified today.
Exactly. And, you know, just going back to that sun example which Swami was giving, actually, Swami makes a very important point. I think it's going to be followed up in probably in the same discourse or the other discourse. Swami says, talks about that first tool to know, what is called as pratyaksha pramanam in Vedantic philosophy, where direct perception.
Yes.
So Swami makes a point. He says, first of all, man established the connection between food and sun.
Right.
So sun became a direct representation of divinity for him. Starts worshipping it. And then when he started this exploration towards, you know, gaining knowledge, he realized that first step, which is called pratyaksha pramanam, is completely based on light, and that light is being given by sun. And that is where the connection between sun and intelligence and sun and knowledge was established. Mm-hmm. And Swami goes on to say, just like how you need light to see, which is the foremost in that pratyaksha pramanam tool, similarly for knowing, it is that intelligence which comes, you know, as an illumination. As you're saying, it's an inspiration. Sometimes it's so serendipitous that you have to believe that there is somebody else who's orchestrating the discovery or the invention.
Right.
I'm just reminded of, sometime back I was reading, of how infrared radiations were discovered.
Mm-hmm.
It's very interesting. You know, there's this German scientist, I think I've got his name here, Frederick William Herschel. He was the person who actually discovered the Uranus.
Okay.
He and his wife are scientists themselves. You know, what they would do is they look up into the sky, and they had this technique. They would have different filters of different colors, and they would look at the planets in the because some of them will not be visible when you just look through the telescope. And when they were doing that, they realized that some colors were cooling to the eye, some colors were actually warm.
Okay.
Okay, so then they realized that when you split white light into this spectrum, each color might have a different temperature. So he devised an experiment by which this light is put through the prism, and each of those colors he measured the temperature. Okay, and then he starts measuring the temperature of each one, and finally comes to red. He realizes that's the hottest, and accidentally he realizes that just beside red the thermometer becomes more hotter.
Okay.
Where there is nothing visible. So that's when he realizes that there is something which is beyond what can be seen also.
Beyond the visible.
Right.
Range.
And he calls it thermal rays initially.
Okay.
Because it's hot rays.
The
beauty of this is, you know, the science talks of it as, here is something which can be seen. Okay. And there is something which can be known by a different way, but the intelligence to connect both and say that there is something which is beyond what can be seen.
No, if you read the life histories of many of the scientists, there is tremendous hard work. There is a lot of reasoning. There is a lot of hard work and, you know, logical flow of ideas and trying to derive. But that moment when they get, it's always a click. It's always given. It's almost as if the Lord above or the force above is waiting. Okay, now you're ready. You take this knowledge. It's almost like that. It's always given. You know, that form of knowledge is given at the right moment. That's how it seems. And I'm not sure who it is. Probably Paramahamsa Yogananda, who said, it's not an accident that the entire consciousness of
the
world,
writes,
I think,
about it, right?
He writes about it, that this is the 20th century is when we have such startling scientific discoveries and inventions. He says it's not an accident. It's a deliberate raising of consciousness.
So it's part of a big evolutionary process of the human intelligence.
And Swami is mapping it And he says how it all started with observation and how it came to, and then now I think the next section is where we go into the significance of God's names.
Yeah, because the human beings wanted to define it and define this relationship and give it a name.
No, more than that, I look at it, if there are the crest of society, like the sages, the Brahmins of those days, they had the understanding and the knowledge to know that, okay, this is the sun, this is the moon, and these are different, but they gave them an identity in the form of a god, so that the regular person, you know, a normal person, a farmer, a householder, they could worship and get the benefit of gratitude. You know, you show gratitude to nature, you worship nature. The moment there is a form attributed to sun, then anybody can easily relate to it. I think that's how it went on, and the sages were the scientists of those days.
Spiritual scientists.
Yeah. So they gave names, they gave a form, they gave attributes.
I think the names are based on the attributes that they fathomed.
Exactly.
And going back to what I said about, you know, the answering of the question how, I think at some point these rishis stopped and asked why.
Okay.
You know, why am I allowed to know? Because, you know, you can endlessly try to find out how does this happen, how does that happen, you know, how does the sun produce heat, how does the soil produce the crops. But at some point he said, why is this happening? You know, why am I allowed to explore nature? Why am I allowed to know things? I think that's when he realized that there is something which is something like a super conscious being, which is probably, you know, eager to be known.
Right.
And I think that's where the whole thing starts, and he, you know, this idea of there is this substratum which is holding all this thing together, and can we get to know that? It takes me back to that legendary conversation between, I think, Shvetaketu and Uddalaka.
Mm-hmm.
You know, have you learned that learning which you have learned all?
Yes.
So at that time the father gives this example, you know, if you know the nature of pot, you know that everything which is, I mean, every shape and every utility of what is made with that clay, you know it because you know the clay.
Correct.
So it's almost like the, you know, the eagerness and the quest to know that. And when Swami spoke about that arithmetic, I think that's where he said that 1 + 1 + 1, nowhere in the pursuit of this knowledge it was forgotten that one was the basis.
Right.
And Swami starts with that by saying that, you know, that is the basis, and Ishavasyam Idam Jagat, that's what the Vedas declared. And I think from there Swami takes off. Swami speaks about the different names of that entity, which is, you know, you can call it divinity, you can call it God, or whatever it is. So shall we go into the clip?
I think it's a good time to do that.
Those people of those ancient days,
Adityaha, ani pilustu vachar.
They call that power as Adityaha.
Adityaha anaga. ద్వాదశాదిత్యులలో ఒక ఆదిత్యుడు అతనే విష్ణువు అని.
ఆదిత్య మీన్స్ అమంగ్ ది 12 ఆదిత్యాస్ ద 12th వన్ దట్ ఇస్ విష్ణు
అనగా కేవలం శంఖ చక్ర గదా పద్మముతో కూడినటువంటిది కాదు. విష్ణు సర్వవ్యాపకమైనటువంటి తత్వము.
విష్ణు డస్ నాట్ రెఫర్ టు ద ఫార్మ్ విచ్ వే హోల్స్ మేస్ కాంచ్ and disc, etc. It is omnipresent and it is found everywhere.
ఇలాంటి విష్ణుత్వానికి మనం ఒక రూపాన్ని కల్పించుకుంటూ వచ్చాం.
For విష్ణుత్వ which is all pervasive is given a form by us.
యముగా విష్ణుత్వం అనగా సర్వవ్యాపకత్వమే అర్థం.
Actually, the విష్ణుత్వ means it is all pervasiveness.
ఏ విధంగా ఒక్కడిని మనం విశ్వసిస్తూ వచ్చాం? ఆదిత్యుని.
How did we began believing in Aditya?
Rajita patralu untai.
There are silver vessels.
Deeniki suvarna patralu untai.
There are golden vessels.
Brass patralu untai.
There are brass vessels.
Copper vessels anta untai.
There are copper vessels.
Matti vessels anta untai.
There are mud pots.
Ivanni kudanu neetito nimpinappudu,
when you fill them with,
అన్నింటి ఎందు కూడా సూర్యుడు ప్రతిబింబిస్తుంటూ ఉంటాడు.
సన్ గెట్స్ రిఫ్లెక్టెడ్ ఇన్ ద వాటర్ ఆఫ్ ఆల్ దీస్ వెసల్స్.
పాత్రలు వేరే కాని,
వెసల్స్ ఆర్ డిఫరెంట్.
పాత్రల యొక్క విలువలు వేరే కాని,
దేర్ వాల్యూస్ ఆర్ డిఫరెంట్.
కానీ అన్నింటి ఎందు సమానంగా ప్రతిబింబిస్తున్నాడు సూర్యుడు.
బట్ సన్ రిఫ్లెక్ట్స్ యూనిఫామ్లీ ఇన్ ఆల్ దీస్
కొన్ని వేల పాత్రలు పెట్టినప్పటికీ వేల సూర్యునిగా కనిపిస్తుంటాడు.
ఇఫ్ యూ కీప్ థౌజండ్స్ ఆఫ్ వెజల్స్ యూ కెన్ సీ థౌజండ్స్ ఆఫ్ సన్స్ రిఫ్లెక్టెడ్ ఇన్ దెమ్.
కానీ పాత్రలు వేలకు ఉంటున్నాయి కానీ సూర్యుడు వేలకు లేరు ఒక్కడే అనేటువంటి సత్యాన్ని అర్థం చేసుకుంటూ వచ్చారు.
మ్యాన్ బిగాన్ రియలైజింగ్ దట్ ది వెసల్స్ ఆర్ థౌజండ్స్ బట్ దెర్ ఇస్ ఓన్లీ వన్ సన్ రిఫ్లెక్టెడ్ ఇన్ దెమ్.
ఈ పాత్రల యొక్క విలువలు రూపములు నామములు వేరువేరుగా ఉండవచ్చు.
ద నేమ్స్ ఫార్మ్స్ అండ్ వాల్యూస్ ఆఫ్ దీస్ వెసల్స్ మే బి డిఫరెంట్.
దీనిని ఆధారం చేసుకుని దేహములనే పాత్రలుగా విశ్వసించుకుంటూ వచ్చారు.
ఆన్ దిస్ బేసిస్ మ్యాన్ బిగాన్ బిలీవింగ్ హిస్ బాడీ ఈజ్ అ వెసల్.
ఈ దేహము మృణ్మయమైనటువంటి దేహము.
దిస్ వెసల్ ఈజ్ మేడ్ అప్ ఆఫ్ మడ్.
ఈ మృణ్మయమైనటువంటి పాత్ర యందు చిన్మయమైనటువంటి యొక్క దివ్యత్వం ఉన్నది అని సత్యాన్ని గుర్తించి వచ్చారు.
హీ ఆల్సో రియలైజ్ దట్ ఇన్ దిస్ మడ్ పాట్ దేర్ ఈస్ దట్ రెస్ప్లెండెంట్ గోల్డ్ కాన్షియస్నెస్ ఇన్ ఇట్.
ఇతనిని హిరణ్య గర్భుడు అని పేరు పెడుతూ వచ్చారు.
హీ హాస్ బీన్ డిస్క్రైబ్డ్ యాజ్ హిరణ్య గర్భ.
కనుక ఈ విధంగా ప్రప్రథమం నుంచి మానవుడు కొద్ది కొద్దిగా అభివృద్దిగా అంచుకుంటూ కట్టకలప్పటికీ ఏకత్వాన్ని గుర్తించుకునేటువంటి యొక్క దివ్యత్వాన్ని సాధించుకుంటూ వచ్చాడు మానవుడు.
ఫ్రమ్ ది ఏన్షియంట్ డేస్ గ్రాడ్యువలీ మ్యాన్ బిగాన్ రియలైజింగ్ దీస్ ట్రూత్స్ అండ్ హీ కేమ్ టు ఎ స్టేజ్ వేర్ ఇన్ హీ రియలైజ్ దట్ దేర్ ఇస్ ఓన్లీ వన్ ఎంటిటీ.
ఇతనికి మరొక పేరు కూడాను సృష్టించుకుంటూ వచ్చారు.
హీ ఆల్సో గేవ్ వన్ మోర్ నేమ్
ఈశ్వరః అన్నారు.
ఈశ్వరః ఈజ్ ద నేమ్ గివన్
అనగా నిరుపమాధమైనటువంటి యొక్క ఐశ్వర్యం కలవాడు. నిరుపాధితమైనటువంటి ఐశ్వర్యం.
ఈశ్వరః మీన్స్ ద వన్ హూ హ్యాస్ ఇన్ఎగ్జాస్టబుల్ వెల్త్.
ఏమిటి ఈ వెల్త్?
వాట్ ఈస్ దిస్ వెల్త్?
హెల్త్ ఒక వెల్తే, ధనం ఒక ధనమే, ఆరోగ్యము ఒక విధమైనటువంటి ధనమే, విద్య ఒక ధనమే, గుణం ఒక ధనమే, తెలివి ఒక ధనమే, సర్వము ధనముల కిందనే పోల్చుకుంటూ వచ్చారు.
Health is wealth, money is wealth, wisdom also is wealth, knowledge is wealth, money is also wealth, success itself is also wealth.
ఇవన్నీ కూడాను ఒక విధమైనటువంటి ధనములే.
All these are different forms of wealth.
కనుకనే సకలైశ్వర్య స్వరూపుడు ఈశ్వరుడు అనేటువంటి సత్యాన్ని దిగారు.
He also believed that God is one who commands all these types of wealth.
సకలైశ్వర్య స్వరూపుడు ఈశ్వరుడు.
Ishwara is one who is having wealth of all types.
Tarvata indulo unnatundi rahasyanni gurtinchi Shivaha ani pilustu vacharu.
After realizing the inner meaning of this, he began calling God as Shivaha.
Shivaha anaga traigunya rahitudu ani artham.
Shivaha means he transcends all the three qualities.
Sattrajo tamo gunamulaku atheetamainatundi vaadu.
He transcends the qualities of sattva, rajas and tamas.
గుణములు లేనటువంటి వాడు కనుక ఇతను శుద్ధ సత్వుడు అని కూడా పిలుచుకుంటూ వచ్చారు.
As he does not have any one of these qualities, he has been described to have pure sattva quality.
శివుడు.
That pure sattva quality is
అదే మంగళకరమైనటువంటి తత్వము.
That is also the principle of auspiciousness.
గుణములు లేనప్పుడే మంగళత్వం ఏర్పడుతుంది.
Where there are no qualities, there is auspiciousness.
గుణములు ఉండినప్పుడే అమంగళం ఏర్పడుతుంది.
Where there are qualities, there is inauspiciousness.
కనుక శివః అనగా మంగళ స్వరూపుడు.
శివః therefore means the most auspicious one.
క్రమక్రమేణ ఇంకా ఉన్నత స్థాయికి వెళుతూ వచ్చారు మానవుడు.
Man began making further progress in his evolution.
శంభః నాలుగో పేరు పెట్టుకుంటూ వచ్చారు.
The fourth name Sambhava.
Sambhava.
Sambhava is given.
Anaga sambhavam ante emiti?
What do you mean by sambhavam?
Tana ishta prakaramu.
According to his own.
Ye neemamulu lekunda.
Without any rules regulation.
Eppudu avasaramo.
Whenever there is need.
Ekkada avasaramo.
Wherever there is need.
Akkadanta ye kalamulo avasaramo.
But whatever time there is need.
Appudanta kudunu. తాను ఉద్భవించేటువంటి యొక్క భావము కలవాణ్ణి సంభవ అన్నారు.
ద వన్ హూ డిసెండ్స్ అండ్ మేనిఫెస్ట్ హింసెల్ఫ్ like this is described as sambhavaha.
Anduvalle Bhagavad Gita lo kudanu yada yada his dharmasya glanirbhavatu bharata abhyuddhanam adharmasya tadatmanam sujamyaham paritranaya sadhunam vinachayata dushkutam dharma samsthapanartaya sambhavami yuge yuge sambhavami. ఎక్కడెక్కడ అవసరమో అక్కడంతా తాను ఉద్భవిస్తూ ఉంటాడు. అలాంటి స్వాతంత్ర్యము కలవాడు కనుకనే అతనికి సంభవః అని పేరు పెట్టారు.
గాడ్ హస్ బీన్ గివెన్ ద నేమ్ సంభవః బికాస్ హీ హాస్ ది ఫ్రీడమ్ టు డిసెండ్ అండ్ మేనిఫెస్ట్ వేర్ ఎవర్ అండ్ వెన్ ఎవర్ ఇన్ వాట్ ఎవర్ ఫారం హీ చూజెస్.
కనుక ఈ విధంగా కూడా భగవంతుడికి అన్ని పేర్లు ఈ విధంగా ఒక్కొక్క అంతరార్థాన్ని పురస్కరించుకుని పేర్లు పెడుతూ వచ్చారు.
దస్ గాడ్ హాస్ బీన్ గివన్ different names depending upon his demands on
Isha.
And that Isha will have to wait till the next clip. And how many names did Swami give there? Four, I think, right?
Aditya, Ishwara, Shiva. And he did mention Hiranyagarbha Vishnu, referring to Aditya is same as Vishnu. So I guess as the thought process evolved and there was progression, humanity or the collective consciousness started giving names according to their understanding. And one thing that is very clear is that God was perceived as being omnipresent, as being all-powerful and the bestower and provider of many blessings.
Right. If you look at it, you know, there's one thing which Swami would often say. I don't know if Swami has said it, but it's definitely mentioned in Swami's presence that a buffalo will pray to God as a cosmic buffalo.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I think this is probably a trend where man looks at his limitations and believes that this divinity must be beyond this limitation. And all the names, if you look at it, it's actually an expression of that thought. Like, for instance, when Swami says Vishnu, Vishnu is omnipresence.
Right.
You know, when this realization comes that I can be only at one place at a given point in time, you know, that's a limitation. So when you think of God as something bigger than me, He must be omnipresent. At all times, He should be able to be everywhere. And that, you know, that description of God is defined in this name which is given Vishnu. Mm-hmm. Right. And then when you look at this thing of Swami saying Ishwara, who is actually inexhaustible.
Mm.
And again, it is like, you know, when you go through life, it's always like how much resources I have, you know, how much can I provide. So you're looking at God as somebody who is having inexhaustible resources.
Who transcends your own limitations.
Right. So each of those limitations and expression of God as somebody who transcends that limitation, you describe God and you give Him a name. So Vishnu for that omnipresence, you know, for the indestructible, Swami says the name of, you know, Chinmayam. Swami says that which is limited is Mrinmayam, that which is limitless is Chinmayam. So the indestructible nature of God is given a name. And all prosperity, that is given the name Ishwara. And then you look at it as, you know, when Swami says Shuddha Sattva, I think that's another limitation which man would have recognized in himself. That is, you know, something which we saw in that 1990 discourse, freedom, who is free?
Right.
So Swami says, you know, even when you're doing an act of charity, you're doing it under the influence of this attribute of goodness.
Yes.
You're not doing it out of your own free will.
Mm.
So probably man would have realized that, you know, whatever I'm doing, I'm bound by these, you know, invisible gunas.
Mm.
So describes God as somebody who's beyond the gunas.
Mm.
And, you know, gives Him a name for that, you know, Shuddha Sattvam or Shiva, as Swami said, who's beyond. And again comes to this, the last name, Sambhava. I think that's again a limitation which we can see in all of us. I have not chosen the family I was born in.
That's right.
I have not chosen, you know, probably given a choice, I would have born probably in the 1950s and come to Swami earlier.
That's right.
That choice was not with us.
Yes.
So again, expressing that ability of God to be beyond that limitation and choice, He says Sambhava. He is somebody who can appear anywhere, anytime, whenever He chooses.
Right.
So it's almost like, you know, describing God as somebody who is, you know, if I'm X, He's infinity X.
Right.
He's so much limitless beyond me.
Now, looking at this segment of the discourse, another thought comes to me that Swami has spent time in describing the names of the Lord. He has not yet come to the forms.
Right.
See, possibly when the sages and when our ancients thought of the Lord, they gave them names. They gave them names pertaining to certain attributes and attributes of which they are beyond. So the names have that potency. And I think in some of Swami's discourses, he mentions, he asks, which kind of sari was Mrs. Brahma wearing? was she wearing a 6-yard sari or a 9-yard sari? And which sari was Mrs. Vishnu wearing? which sari was Mrs. Shiva wearing? This is all imagination, imagination, imagination. This is all your Raja Ravi Verma's imagination. You know, that is so powerful here, because one of the main criticisms of religious thought possibly is that we get diverted into the rituals and the form aspect and worship of the form.
And the imagery. Yeah.
We go behind the imagery, forgetting the source of that imagery, what it stands for. And here when Swami is trying to bring about, he is trying to connect us to the purpose why such a name was given to that aspect of God. See, it's here you still see that these are all aspects of one God.
Right.
You don't see them as Vishnu separately, you don't see it as Shiva separately, you don't see them as different forms of God. We see them as attributes of that one God.
Right.
And I find that Swami's delivery of this lesson plan is so organic, because he's trying to teach us as novices, but he begins from this perspective of Nirguna Brahman. And we haven't gone to Sagun really, in the sense that form hasn't come in and many other attributes. He's just keeping it very pure, very clean and clear, that these are the attributes of God, whether it's omniscience, is abundance, the bestower of abundance of health, wealth, prosperity, intelligence, talent, or one who is all that and beyond. So he's really building a case step by step, because as we will progress, we will realize he's all this, but he's not bound by even these. He's beyond all this and none of all these. So it's a very confusing logic, but Swami is building it in such a careful manner so that we can relate to it, and we can relate to how people thought at that time. And it's like plugging into their stream of consciousness to see how they tried to grapple with this issue of a force which was so much larger than themselves. And it represented humanity's collective wishful thinking of what should be, not realizing what later Swami told us, we are all also the same. Right. At that time, we were bound by our limitations. So this represents our wishful thinking of being somebody beyond these attributes of time and space. And, you know, how I wish I could be right now transported to a beautiful island in the Caribbean on a holiday. Now, if sorry. I was Sambhavami...
Sorry, you are not Vishnu. You cannot be omnipresent.
Thank you for that sad reminder, CG. But if I was the Sambhavami God, right away.
No, but if you realize who you actually are, possibly you could do it.
Yes, beam me Scotty right no, there.
That's the beauty. In fact, in one of the discourses, Swami says, that's why Vishnu represents the mind.
Yes. Mm.
Because the moment you think of probably Hawaii, you know, destination... Your body might not be there, but your mind is there.
Mind is there, very much so.
So the mind actually is a representation of Vishnu, because it has the ability to be at all places at all times, whichever places it chooses to be at least. And I think probably another reason why it was easy for them to see God, I mean attribute names but not attribute forms, is, you know, the moment you start going out and say that, oh, sun is like a god, water is like a god, you're already starting with beyond the human form.
Right.
I mean, you're not starting with somebody who should be like me with two limbs, or, you know, let's give him the credit by giving him four limbs instead of two hands and that sort of a thing. The ability to see beyond a form, fixed form, comes when you already have started looking at the sun and saying that, you know, probably sun is the god, or probably the earth itself is the god, probably right. This air which I'm breathing is the god. And another thing which Swami says, you know, that simile which Swami uses of the different pots which are made of different material reflect the same sun. This again is a peek into the thought process. But you know, this is how the early man would have started exploring.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, looked at a phenomenon such as this, reflection. And probably would have wondered, is this the same with, you know, the life form inside me? just like how the same sun is being reflected in so many, could it be possible that one is being reflected in the many?
Yeah.
And I think you can't take away the importance of similes in understanding and learning.
That's true. In fact, you know, when we talk of how the different names of gods have evolved from what they perceive in nature,
right,
and what they study in nature, you know, many of the scientists, even modern scientists who are atheists,
mm-hmm,
they, you know, I just was reading about a quote from many centuries back by the Byzantine church, I believe from Greek area. They said the study of nature was the surest symptom of an unbelieving mind.
Mm-hmm.
So the atheists are quoting it as a closed approach, that the spiritualists and the religious people did not allow people to explore freely. You know, so they say that the study of nature was the surest symptom of an unbelieving mind. But how contrary it is to what Swami is saying,
right,
and how open Swami's point of view is, and how the Indian school of thought possibly is, where we looked at nature and connected to God. And this is so much in sync with that hierarchy which Swami often says, individual, society, nature and God.
Mm-hmm.
So, it is through your perception of nature and understanding of nature that you eventually go towards God.
And you know, Vedanta represents the culmination of all thought when it comes to looking for the ultimate reality. But pantheism, which is looking for God in nature, was very much recognized in the Indian culture. That's why, because we were in awe of the hidden fire between the twigs, so we worshipped fire.
Exactly.
We were in awe of the wind, which we could not see but feel, and in awe of water, which man could not create. So we knew they were these elements which are larger than us, bigger than us, and they were life-sustaining, and the sun, of course. That's why we worship the elements.
That's right. In fact, you know, on a lighter note, we got a recent WhatsApp forward,
mm-hmm,
in which there is this son and the mother is saying, come for food, and the son says, wait, I've got to study up this Charles Darwin's theory of evolution.
Mm-hmm.
And the mother says, see, I've not studied Charles Darwin's theory of evolution, but this is a sequence of the 10 avatars. Then she says, Matsya avatar is a fish. Kurma avatar is an amphibian. And then you get mammals, and then you get half man, half animal, Narasimha avatar. Then you get a Vamana, who was a short, maybe it's another species of Homo erectus or Homo sapiens. I mean, there is a beautiful correlation, and it was a WhatsApp message. I mean,
Swami had mentioned this, I think, when the boys were putting up a Ramzan program,
okay,
Swami was having a session with them in the bhajan hall.
Yes.
At that time, Swami explained this entire thing, how evolution is nothing but the dasha avatars.
Yeah. So the entire process that science is discovering today was well known to our ancients, and they gave them names and attributes, which is so much more lovable and so much more, I mean.
And without discounting the need for reverence, you know,
yeah,
if you look at it, I mean, I go into a class, there's a teacher. The teacher is not giving me anything new. She's picking up from a textbook, or, you know, from what is already there, and she's giving.
That's right.
But still, we see a need to have reverence towards the teacher.
Correct.
I think it's the same thing, you know, when with this analogy which Swami is giving. The sun is being the first teacher.
Right.
You know, by this simple act of reflecting on so many water bodies, the sun is actually driving such an important lesson. So immediately the sun becomes, you know, takes the role of a teacher and demands that reverence from man. I think that's why even after probably understanding, Swami says in the beginning part of the discourse, that eventually they understand that helium and hydrogen is causing the sun to give heat. But still, I think that reverence towards the sun never faded out. Knowing the science behind that object did not take away the reverence for that object. I think that is where probably, you know, you all the time grow, but don't grow so much that you go beyond respect and reverence.
You know, at the cost of a very big digression here, there is this beautiful story where Krishna is actually leaving the village, and he's going back to Mathura. And all the Gopikas are not able to accept it. And they are pleading, and then Krishna has just decided to leave. And then they finally go to Radha, and they say, you are our leader, and if you tell Krishna, he will definitely not leave. Okay. So Then she just smiles and she says, how can I tell Krishna? She says, we are like the 1,000 pots of clay and he is like the sun.
Oh, beautiful.
She actually says that. She says, we are 1,000 pots. We are Prakriti. We are nowhere. How can you say, his reflection is seen in your pot, he is seen in my pot. That does not mean he belongs only to us. He is like the sun. And his reflection is in all the pots. It's exactly what Swami is saying here. And so she was in sync with that truth. So possibly that's why she is Radha.
Absolutely. I think that's probably the hint that all of this knowledge is accessible through devotion.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, that's exactly what Krishna says in the Gita. You know, he says, after giving all Sankhya Yoga and Jnana Yoga, he finally says, man comes to know me through devotion.
Yeah. And even in this discourse, as we will go along, Swami mentioned the need for humility and devotion to access and to create that personal relationship with the God and to realize. And speaking of nature, Swami also said that nature is the best teacher. So when he said when nature is the best teacher, he meant there were so many lessons we could learn from nature. That also evokes us, because that evokes a sense of reverence for nature, because it's so methodical, it's so systematic, it's so disciplined, it brings back, so it's so selfless and giving. So it was only natural for early man to have that reverence for something, another reason for them to have reverence for nature.
Very true.
Right. There's another clip, but I don't think we'll have time for another clip to be played. But then, just going back to this clip where Swami is talking about yada yada hi dharmasya, glanin. I don't know, the question which might rise is, so if you want God to manifest, let's mess with dharma. But you know, that's the beauty in I think the Bhagavad Vaini, in the introduction to the Bhagavad Vaini, Swami says,
okay,
he says, you know, there are many reasons God comes, but the first and foremost reason is to satisfy the yearning of devotees. You know, the adharma part actually comes later. And very interestingly, in another discourse which I came across, where Swami says, it's a beautifully logically Swami puts it. He says, see, first of all, God does not see the difference between good and bad. Then how can he say that you're bad, let me come and transform you? He says God can only see the good. So whenever he comes, it's only in response to goodness, but never in response to the evil. Probably, I mean, it's almost like an afterthought. I mean, having come, let me...
Might as well.
You know, correct the wrong too.
And you know, this progression of thought that Swami spoke of and we discussed so far about describing God as Vishnu or Hiranyagarbha or Ishvara and Shiva, I think the progression also was reflected in Swami's own life, because he often told us that when I am amongst men, I am a man. When I am with ladies, I am a lady. When I am with children, I am like a child. And we have so many instances how Swami related to the children of the primary school. So each one according to their own level of understanding and evolution, God becomes what you think God is. He is a customized order at any point in time. And he's just a sum total of our aspirations and our imaginations about this phenomena, which is impossible to capture cohesively, completely at an individual level.
Right. And going back to that quote, really, it only, I mean, what we speak of in, I think, physics as of the observer effect. Now, as long as there is an observer, the observed is not absolute. Because when Swami says, you know, when I'm with men, I'm a man. When I'm with children, I'm a child. He says, when I'm alone, I'm God.
Yes.
And many times it would, you know, occur to me, especially when you're sitting in for bhajans, Swami would go inside for an interview. After the interview, Swami will send out those people who are there, and Swami will remain in the interview room for a few minutes all alone.
Yes.
There'll be that time the temptation of, you know, if we now probably go and peep into the room, you can see Swami as God. But the moment you peep in, the observer comes in and, you know, the observed is not absolute
anymore.
Reminded, I think it was Sonam sir who shared that very beautiful incident. I think when Swami had taken them to Delhi, he was in his 12th standard. He was a very young boy, and they had this opportunity of sleeping on the corridor which is just outside Swami's door.
Okay.
So as a young boy, he was so excited about it to be, you know, that thought that there's just a door and on the other side there's Swami sleeping.
Correct.
So he was sitting there and, you know, he was not getting sleep in that excitement. So after everybody had gone to sleep, he said, let me go and peep in and see what Swami is doing.
Through the keyhole.
Through the keyhole, yeah. And you know, this boy gets up, it slowly crawls and peeps into the keyhole. And imagine, it's dark even in Swami's room. Mm. Because Swami would do that, you know. Swami would just leave the light of the bathroom on. Mm. Though he's awake, he would not switch on the light. So this boy, imagine, it's so dark outside, it's dark inside. Mm. And he peeps in through the keyhole. The moment he peeps in, he hears a voice, "Hey." Right, you know, he says, how do you catch Swami when he's alone? It's impossible, isn't it?
Really amazing. You know, and this aspect of Shiva, which Swami is saying, how he transcends the three gunas, going back to that scientific discourse that we had, you know, in the 1990 series, how the combinations of the five panchabhutas and in their manifestations of sattva, rajas and tamas, how that's how the whole creation came about.
Mm-hmm.
It is almost impossible for us to disassociate and go beyond the three gunas. So unless you are in that state of awareness where
absolutism,
where you live that experience. Mm-hmm. It's not only that you believe, but you actually live the experience of being beyond the three gunas. And that is what Swami says is Shiva.
In fact, going back to that discourse, you know, Swami says that initially all the five elements,
mm-hmm.
Swami doesn't call it, I think he gives it a name, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Before the gross elements come, the subtle elements.
Subtle elements.
Swami gives a name for that.
Mm-hmm.
I think, absolutely missing my memory now. So that element, you know, Swami says the first, those five elements come actually as an expression of sattva.
Hmm.
So if you look at it, it is like, you know, if you really have to explain it, there is something which cannot be known in any way,
mm-hmm.
because it doesn't have any attributes. Now to know anything, like for instance, if you have to know any object, it should either have a form, or you should be able to feel it, like wind or something, or you should be able to smell it. So it was almost like this, there is this absolute which cannot be known or felt or in any way, suddenly decides, let me be known. So the first process is gain attributes.
Exactly. The first process of manifestation,
right,
is to come within the attributes.
Right. So that's how Swami says that the five elements are actually an expression of sattva, which, you know, first it becomes sound and first then it becomes that which can be
shabda, sparsha, rupa,
right, all of that. And here Swami is saying that the Lord is Shuddha Sattva, which means when you remove even the attribute, I mean, later Swami says how the Sattvic itself is a combination of all of this put together,
right,
and all that. And when you say Shuddha Sattva, I think it's very close to what, you know, the Vedic aphorism which says that Prajnanam Brahma.
Yes.
Just that knowledge, that knowing alone itself is Brahma. Because when you say Sattva, I think it relates to knowing. That which is, you know, which decided to be known. So I think sattva actually represents that knowing, and Swami is saying that Shuddha Sattva is God. I think it's the same as Prajnanam Brahma.
Yeah, so here we are talking about the names and why they are so significant. But as we discussed earlier, even the forms of the Lord, like here Swami is talking about Vishnu and how it actually means all pervasive. But everything that Lord Vishnu had, including the conch, the chakra, the mace, the flower, all of them are symbolic.
Mm.
Like the conch is probably symbolic of the five elements, shabda, sparsha, rupa, rasa, gandha. And then of course the chakra is a wheel of time and how it controls all the six seasons with the six spokes. And then you have the gada, power. So, and lotus is that purity, that urge for creation. I mean, that these are different explanations given to the different forms of the Lord. And, you know, in sharp contrast with this, again going back to what scientists and science perceives, Richard Feynman, who is supposed to be a leading scientist in quantum mechanics and quantum science. So he says the theory that it's all arranged as a stage for God to watch man's struggle for good and evil seems inadequate. No, because, you know, they are looking at our sun and our solar system as a speck in the entire universe. And they are able to probe into, other universes and other galaxies. So they suddenly realize, isn't our world too small? And aren't we talking too big of ourselves? But the fact that this world is what is enabling you to perceive, your life on this earth is what is giving you the power and the ability to look beyond, is, I think, forgotten in this statement.
I think so too. And I also feel that what we studied till now in today's discourse, so simply it just occurred to me that Swami said that initially he was all by himself. It was pure consciousness, absolutism. And he was getting bored, so he decided. and he had this thought where he decided the manifestation happened. So that's when the gunas came. The mountains rose, the rivers started to fly, the trees, the flora, the fauna, the birds. And then he wanted somebody who was as intelligent enough to recognize this beauty and the power behind it. And he created himself. Sorry, he created us. He created humanity. So in the process, from absolutely no guna to creating an interplay of the three gunas or the three qualities which fell into this interplay, and what came out of it is the entire creation and the drama that we live as a human experience. It all seems, as we could easily say, as Swami's Leela. And that's pretty much what he has taught us so far in terms of, I mean, there are so many layers of understanding it, but to simplify it as a student, I see it as that.
You know, talking about giving that form and getting confused because of the form. I think the whole thing is that, you know, when you say that Vishnu has four
arms,
when you talk about attributelessness and then you talk about a form, it's almost like, you know, the way I would like to think of it is, if somebody comes and asks you, you know, can you describe Swami's perfume? Like, you know, we've all enjoyed that fragrance, you know, wafted past us when Swami comes for darshan. We've all experienced it. Now, if I have to explain that fragrance to somebody who has never experienced it,
it's only through a simile or through...
Yeah, probably I can think of four fragrances and say that, you know, all of this put together. or I can you know, describe it like, you know, that's a fragrance, when it comes, you remember this, or you know, it gives you this feeling of exhilaration. But all this can only be representative of that fragrance which we've experienced, but never can be complete. But I think over time, if this gets documented and says that this is what the fragrance, you know, and everybody believes that this is the fragrance and starts trying to recreate the fragrance based on these references, I think that's precisely what we've done with the forms of Vishnu, Shiva, and, you know, what was representative has become something like a blocked and hard concretization of that particular entity.
And that's the danger of symbolism. Sometimes symbolism becomes, is perceived as the reality.
Right, right. And I think all said and done, we've spoken so much about it. Wonder where we are in that understanding itself.
That's true.
You know, that's the beauty. We can speak of all the absoluteness, but end of the day, we're going to think of Swami and thank Swami for the opportunity. And, you know, and even as we thank, it's just that same form which was so beautiful, it comes to our mind. And I don't think we need to worry about that. And really, it's a wonder, if not for Swami, if not for this being Swami's discourse, I wonder if I would have read it.
That's right.
And I think that is where we all, you know, we owe all our gratitude to that devotion which Swami inspired in all of us. Because the ability to even look at these deeper things is because, you know, his words matter. And to love him, we have to look at his words.
Yeah.
And I think that's the idea behind this entire program. So, dear listeners, thank you for being with us. And of course, thanks to Didi for joining us. We offer this effort on behalf of both of them. I offer this effort at Swami's Lotus Feet. In a short while from now, you'll be joined by Brother Bishu for the last program of the day, Outside Inside, Deep Inside. Thank you for being with us. Do continue listening to the last segment of today.
Sairam.
Sairam.